Hey, you cool cats and kittens. It is Kenny McIntosh here, and it's a new interview cast. I've not done one of these in ages. With COVID, it's been trying to get interviews for like the YouTube channel, since there's no live shows, and it's been trying to keep everything going. So I've not really had a chance to do any of these in a while, but I've decided, I thought this would be a great chat to have. I recently read the new Eighth Wonder of the World, True Story of Andre the Giant book, and it is really good. But like, you know that I won't promote something unless I think it's actually good. So sometimes if I'm promoting a book, I'll just kind of go straight to the interview and not mention the book. But this one really is good. It's the real story of Andre the Giant, the kind of story of the guy behind the giant. And it's written by Bertrand Hébert, who I, came over with Pat Patterson. We did the tour in 2018. And Pat LaPraz, who worked on the Andre documentary for HBO. They both also wrote a Mad Dog Vachon autobiography, a Montreal book called Mad Dogs, Midgets and Screwjobs, Women of the Squared Circle book, and now the Andre book. So it's me talking to Bertrand and Pat for about 50 minutes, I think it is, and we just talk about some of the big stuff, that, and it's quite easy to follow up. We're not talking about Andre's early life, but that is in the book and it is really interesting. But in this, we talk about WrestleMania 3, we talk about him doing The Princess Bride, we talk about Hogan and Andre drawn 33 million viewers on a TV show in early 1988. So that's on there. Andre's legacy, working with Warrior. It's a really good chat, so I hope you guys will enjoy it. We have also recorded a video version, so the video version is actually going to be going up on our Patreon in the next couple of days. So if you are not subscribed, patreon.com/insidetheropes for that. And we'll also be putting video clips up of this interview on our YouTube channel as well. So it's synergy is the word that they use. It's one of those wanky words. Synergy across all platforms. So that's what I've been learning to do in this pandemic era, is more wanky words. More wanky words to use. And then we're doing an interview today talking about the biography of a guy who didn't have a theme song. So I'm trying to think of what theme song I could play at the end of this podcast for Andre the Giant. So while I think about that, thank you guys for listening to this. Thanks for checking out. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Please do let me know on Twitter at KennyMC1985 if you enjoyed it. And I really do urge you to buy the books on Amazon. It's really, really good. And here is Pat LaPrade and Bertrand Hébert talking about the true story of Andre the Giant, the Eighth Wonder of the World. And we're back here in Inside the Ropes, and I'm very, very pleased to have two authors who are just ingrained in wrestling fans' minds now. They just keep writing these books. It is The Eighth Wonder of the World, The True Story of Andre the Giant by Pat LaPrade and my good friend Bertrand Hébert. We're back together again. How are you guys?
I'm good, good. Good to see you. Everything is going back slowly to normal for you guys.
Yeah, the UK is just recovering from Pat Patterson in 2018, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Just getting back to normal.
It was the Pat 19.
The Pat, well,
Pat 18 of, instead of COVID 19.
Yeah, Pat 18. Honestly, I never thought I would end up in a gay bar in Manchester with Pat Patterson. But there you go. That's where life takes you. You just
none of us would.
I want to talk to you guys about this book. I mean, taking on a book of Andre the Giant, it's almost like before you even start, you have to like break down the myths to tell the facts and all that kind of stuff. So I know you guys had mentioned in the book that when you'd written your Montreal Midgets and Screwjobs book, that you'd kind of talked about some of the Andre myths. So can you guys talk about the process of deciding, right, let's try and get the real story of not only Andre the Giant, but Andre Rusimov as well?
Well, you see, that's a process. I mean, when we put the first book out, I mean, we met more and more people and we learned more and more intimate details about a wrestler's career. And we got closer to a lot of our original interviewee, you know, especially here, like Gino Brito was partnered with Andre, Rick Martel, and those guys. So, you know, as you grew your, their trust in you grows, you get more and more info and, you know, things become clearer. So with Andre, it's a little bit of that, is that as, you know, the more we learn and talk, then, you know, things became a little bit clearer and different. And when Pat worked on the documentary, then, you know, a few more things fell down, especially when he was able to talk with his brothers in France. So it's like, okay, well, there's a lot more there than, you know, the redwood tree falling down on the street and Edouard Carpentier finding him about on the border of the street and picking him up and making him a wrestler. So how do we go from there? How do we work that out? And there's the whole Japan part, the Europe part, and the UK part we fell into without even barely knowing that he had been there. So it's like, okay, we have to cut down everything down and make sure that we bring, you know, the person behind all of that. And funny enough, Andre ended up being the one who promoted the fiction as much as anybody else. So it was a fun process, but a necessary one if we wanted to know the man behind the legend.
I mean it was very important for us to make sure that once and for all the true story of Andre would be told, you know, because there's been a few books, documentaries, and, you know, for different reasons, no other project was able to go at length and make sure that, you know, all of the details, all of the real story of Andre could be, you know, what was being told. So that was one of our main goals, to make sure that not only would talk about the man and the wrestler, but also that every single urban legend that we have heard or read about Andre would be debunked, you know. So we needed to explain why, you know, what was the urban legend, what was the real story, and what happened there, you know, why that urban legend became a reality for so many fans. So it was part of the process as well. And, you know, it's one of the main things that that we're getting comments, you know, that, you know, we're telling the real story. And you know what? At the end of the day, the real story was good enough. The real story is interesting enough that it didn't need to be colored. It didn't need to be exaggerated. So that's why we come up with a book of 500 pages, you know.
Yeah, and you could have done more. And I'll stick with you, Pat, on this one first as well. One of the parts, because like you said, there's so much in this book. You guys talk about, you know, Andre's parents and how they come to be together before they have Andre after World War II and everywhere he goes to wrestle. But one of the points that I kind of just felt was quite hard to read was Andre's relationship with his daughter, Robin, and how he, you know, he met the mum. And there was a quote in the book that I think was from the woman Jackie that Andre had lived with for a while, and he'd said that when women, one of the reasons he might not have got closer to a woman or stayed with a woman was that they just wanted the physical adventure of being with a giant. So, I mean, how was that to kind of try and tell that story as well about his relationship with his daughter? Because it is really fascinating.
Yeah, well, you know, in all of our books, we're trying to not pull any punches, you know. We're telling the story as it is. Sometimes it comes with, you know, good stories or, you know, feel-good stories. And sometimes, well, we show a certain side of a story or of the person we're talking about that is sometimes different, you know. So in Andre's life, women was always something that, where, you know, women were always present in his life, but at the same time, no one really knew about it. You know, everybody knew he had girlfriends from time to time, but it's a subject that we needed to talk about. So whether it was Pat Patterson telling us a story about Andre meeting a French girl in a hotel, or it was Jackie telling us that he had women coming to visit him at the ranch in Ellerbe, North Carolina, or, you know, whether it was with Robin's mother, you know, it was a subject that needed to be approached, to be talked about, and a subject that we didn't really see in you know, the other projects done on Andre, you know. So when we say that it's the most completed, most complete project ever done on Andre, Well, we felt comfortable saying that because we really talk about everything that needed to be talked about, and you know, including this.
I mean, and the thing with this daughter relationship is that any celebrity in his shoes, I mean, would have been in a very bad situation, especially with this strained relationship with the mother, because, you know, he couldn't go anywhere with his daughter. Mm-hmm. He was a giant basically all the time. So that, you know, going to Disneyland with his daughter, that's not an option. Even going to the mall with her is not really an option, at least when she was very young. So that created a bunch of issues, and it's part of the tragic life because, you know, as much as we want it to be a perfectly good story with a big bow tie on top, I mean, it's not a perfect story, and it's a very tragic life. He was younger than me when he passed away. So that's something. I'm 49. So he lived two lifetimes in a span of less than 50 years. But in those 46 some years, you know, he made a lot of mistakes. And he had, because of the way things were with wrestling, had to pass on or let go or not take care of stuff that today we take for granted, that, you know, that family comes first and all that. But wrestling always came first for the Giant.
Yeah, and Andre, sorry, Kenny. Andre couldn't hide under a hat and a pair of sunglasses, you know. Mm-hmm. So everywhere he was going, he was pointed at. He was touched. You know, people wanted to touch him. Children were either scared of him or just wanted to touch him or to be close. So he couldn't go anywhere without having, you know, a bunch of people around him. So having a young daughter wasn't the you know, he couldn't bring her to anywhere. You know, so he needed to talk to her over the phone or to have, you know, private meetings with her in other people's places, because mm-hmm. that's, you know, the only places where Andre could be himself and not just Andre the Giant.
Yeah, and you guys go into a lot more detail to that in the book, obviously. One of the other things, and I might just be adding a narrative to this that isn't there, but when you guys talk about, you know, him doing the Princess Bride and the idea that had been in development for like over a decade or about a decade when they finally did it, and he had that role, I mean, do you think he kind of knew, you know, this role will sort of iconify me, like this is something that, you know, because him wrestling, you know, in the 50s and 60s or 60s and 70s in Japan, the UK, that's not on tape, whereas if he does this movie, The Princess Bride, that's going to be there forever. Like, do you think that was in his mind from the conversations you had, and how important was him doing that movie to sort of his legacy?
I mean, it's very important to his legacy because that goes beyond wrestling. I have people at work who knew The Princess Bride and knew the character and knew that actor in the movie, but they didn't know he was a wrestler, you know. Mm-hmm. That's going to be there forever. It's going to move on. It's on Disney Plus right now, and you know, everybody can see that. But I don't think he realized how much of an impact it would have on his legacy, because, you know, what I think he found in it is that maybe there's something else I can do besides wrestling, and there was a push for that afterwards, and a few tries and attempts. And even, you know, a movie that was released after he passed away. Although physically, since the acromegaly was taking such a toll on him, except for the look, you know, he was losing all other attributes that would help him get those special role on the television. But they just take the Big Show today. I mean, back then, there was a lot less options. You know, it's not impossible to think that, you know, if it would have happened today, he could have retired early and become an actor. And, you know, when he was not in pain, and, you know, there was so much more he could do in the way he plays a role, and he dived so much into that role. I mean, learning his lines perfectly and all that, which the producers and director were not sure he was going to pull. He really loved the experience. And, you know, a lot of wrestlers can testify that they had to watch The Princess Bride on quite numerous occasions on the bus in Japan or in his hotel. You know, sometimes lunch came with that. But still, you know,
he's very proud of it.
Over and over again. Even at LRB, I mean, when he had visit. I mean, he would play the movie for everyone all the time, apparently. So it made an impact on him, but I don't think he could ever imagine that it would be available on the Click stream today at any point for anyone having Disney Plus. So I think that's a really cool thing, though, that, you know, he can be remembered for more than what he did in the ring.
I do believe that if the movie would have came in his career 10 years before, Andre's career would have been totally different, because he enjoyed himself so much on that set. When he was wrestling, a locker room was like a sanctuary for him. You know, he really, really enjoyed being with the boys, playing cards, even more than traveling. Or, you know, at this point of his life in the mid 80s, probably more than going there and having a match. You know, he really enjoyed being there just with the boys and playing cards and you know, making pranks and all that. So he found that atmosphere, that same feeling when he was on Princess Bride set. And I think that if that movie would have came out 10 years before, more producers would have realized that he really had a real talent for acting. He would have been in better shape and better physical shape to do more of that kind of those kind of movies. And you never know, maybe his wrestling career would have been put aside and would have become that mainstream actor, pretty much like Dwayne Johnson is right now. Maybe not as much, maybe I'm exaggerating a little, but all I'm saying is that maybe his wrestling career, he would have not had to wrestle that long, because mm-hmm. he would have found that same feeling he had in a wrestling locker room on a movie set. And that's just a tragedy that, you know, this movie happened so late in his life, when, you know, he couldn't even grab Robin Wright dropping from a few feet, because his arm weren't strong enough by that time. So that's really a tragedy that this movie came so late in his life, but he was really, really proud of it.
And you can even tell when you watch the movie, like, you know, you guys detail a lot of the stuff that he couldn't do and what they had to kind of do to have somebody fall on him without any weight. And you would never know watching the movie. And he does the role so well. But like you say, maybe if it had been 10 years before, it would have worked out better for him. I mean, you guys detail this. It's in the introduction to the book. It's a major chapter. But let's talk about the real story of WrestleMania 3 and the match with Hogan and Andre, because it's still today the body slam with Hogan and Andre. If you only started watching wrestling 5 years ago, you know that body slam. You it's iconic. And one of the parts of the book that I thought was really interesting was you guys talked about David Letterman wanted Andre on his show the night that Hogan won the belt from the Iron Sheik. So, I mean, in terms of the match with Hogan, how important was that for Andre? Do you think he saw this was the big hurrah, you know, the kind of final peak for him?
Well, I don't think, you know, any wrestler really believe it's the big hurrah or the last tour, as they say. They always think that they have more, and until the end, Andre always believed that he had more, I think. Although he knew how important it was, and he knew that Hogan was going to be the new so-and-so Andre, or the new star, that's pretty clear, because his body couldn't keep up at that point. Although at WrestleMania 3, it's a very interesting concept, because the famous surgery for his back that we've heard so much about would actually happen after WrestleMania and not before. And that surgery brought that concept that maybe WrestleMania 3 would be his last match. So in that sense, he knew how important that would be for him and his legacy. And, you know, when we had talked to Carpentier for the first book, he had mentioned that he had asked Andre about it, and that Andre saw that by interlocking his legacy with Hulk Hogan's legacy at WrestleMania 3, it would carry on his own legacy forever. And that's pretty much what happened. I mean, the Hogan legacy or story is tied to that moment in time. WWE has even put that moment in time basically as the centerpiece of everything. It opens every show and will continue to open every show, I believe. So, more and more, it will always be there somehow. And every year, except for this year, obviously, but they're going to have the Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal. So that's always going to bring back the Andre's name. And he's clearly been put in that mytho of WWE as the centerpiece with Hulk. So I think in that sense, it is a pinnacle of the former star passing on the torch to the new star.
What is also very important to understand, and that's a point we're making in the book, is that Andre's career didn't end with WrestleMania 3. It actually started something else. You know, it started the whole foundation of WWE pay-per-views, because when you look at the storyline with Hogan, not only, you know, you have WrestleMania 3, then he has his back surgery. He comes back for Survivor Series in 1987, the very first Survivor Series that is built around Team Hogan against Team Andre. Then you have the February 5th, 1988 main event show that drew 33 million people, the most ever wrestling show, the most watched show ever in the U.S., and before that, you have Royal Rumble 1988, which was based upon the contract signing of that February match between Hogan and Andre. And then you have WrestleMania 4, that, you know, the only match you really wanted to see in the tournament was Hogan and Andre, because you didn't even know who was going to make it to the main event, to the final of the tournament. And then you have the very first SummerSlam at the end in August of 1988, which is the Mega Bucks against the Mega Powers, Andre and DiBiase against Hogan and Savage. So you have the Big Four, what we usually call the Big Four, were based on that rivalry, on that feud between Hogan and Andre. And that's something that people never talk about. But when you look at the numbers, that's when Andre made the most money. That feud was really, really build the foundation of all the pay-per-views WWE is still doing to this day. Because that Big Four was, for the longest time, the only four WWE would have. And they would make much more on pay-per-views than the NWA or WCW would do at the same time. And Hogan and Andre were really important for that. So his career didn't end with WrestleMania 3. Something else started that day. And it was very important for us to talk about that as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like you say, I mean, because when I was growing up, I was watching, those were my first kind of pay-per-views. I'd watch in VHS, the WrestleMania 3, the SummerSlam 8, WrestleMania 4, Survivor Series. But I mean, what's weird when you read the story is that WrestleMania 3, you mentioned in there, the two Piper's Pits basically sell WrestleMania. And, you know, WrestleMania 3 is one of the three highest gates that WWE have ever done. But I've got to think that, like, when WWE sold WrestleMania 32 in Dallas, they really just sold that on the brand of WWE, whereas they really got, you know, 93,173. I don't want to get the number wrong. got to keep to the narrative. But it felt like, from reading the book, you know, they really built that on Hogan and Andre. And, you know, you guys talked about how he had just come back from Princess Bride, where he was really injured. So it's even more impressive when you really look at the detail as to how they made that main event work and sold that show.
I'll never be able to watch that match the same way again, knowing that Andre got the surgery after the match and not before. Mm-hmm. So it's even more impressive. And you can see in the match that there's some subtle ways that Andre was doing things to protect his back and to help him being able to finish it. So it's even more impressive. But it was the perfect storyline, right? It was two friends, one who decided to turn against the other because the other one was having all the spotlight. And Andre knew how to be a heel from Japan. People didn't know that here at the time, but Andre was always a heel in Japan. So he knew what to do and how to do it. So that was nothing new for him. He already had 17 years of experience, you know, being a heel. So that chemistry between him and Hogan was just magic, and people just bought into it.
And then, I mean, you touched on it briefly there as well. We hear the Raw ratings every week now, you know, 1.6 million viewers, 33 million viewers on February 5th, 1988, watched the main event with Hogan and Andre. And again, it's like that match, the build up to it, they had a plan, they put it into motion months before. I mean, it's when you read it on paper, it's kind of, you understand why it drew such a big rating, right? Because they were building to the next chapter of Hogan Andre, and the next time you're going to actually get to see them one-on-one in a singles match, which was almost a year since WrestleMania 3.
I mean, the timelines was moving so much slower, and you know, the anticipation of every show and every match was what made everything. And you are correct in the assessment that, you know, today they draw on the brand more than any specific individual. And at the time, it was really the Andre Mito versus the Hulk Hogan superhero character, and that clash of personality. And it's such a simple story, you know. Former enemies become best friend, tag team partner. Then the young guy becomes the champion and the star. And then the older gentleman and the older star, you know, is jealous. And the bad guy manager gets in his head. And then we have, you know, best friends colliding. And that led them right into the Macho Man and Hulk Hogan storyline. I mean, there's a point to be made that between WrestleMania 3 and WrestleMania 5, it's some of the best storytelling on top they've ever did, as far as being so natural. And they had so many highballs on the TV at the time that it has a lasting impact until today. You know, because even if they stop watching, you know, everybody remembers. I remember in high school, how many people at that time saw those matches. You know, today my kids, you know, nobody at school watches wrestling. My time, even people who were not fans were aware of those storylines, just because it had such a bigger impact than just the wrestling bubble.
And you talk as well about that match at the end when Andre becomes the WWF champion. He, for 1 minute and 48 seconds, but he is the WWF champion at that point. And he makes that famous promo where he says, you know, the World Tag Team Championship. And yeah. I can't imagine anybody else would have been able to get away with that. But, you know, that was the whole respect of Andre, right? He was it that, you know, you were not going to, after everything he put into this and everything that he gave them, from WrestleMania 3, he got to do that.
Yeah, I mean, just Andre being Andre. I mean, according to Gene Okerlund, which I was able to interview just before his passing, I mean, basically, you know, nobody mentioned anything. It's like, okay, well, you know, we're not going to say anything. He's Andre, it's okay. It's going to get by, you know, nobody's going to make a big fuss out of it. And, you know, everybody got the point.
He said it twice. Not only once, he said it twice. Yeah. I mean,
he was nervous. He was allowed to be nervous, right? You know, it's the biggest championship he ever won. I don't know. I mean, that's one interesting question, funny question to start an interview if Andrew was alive today is what happened? And I'm pretty sure probably something very simple like, you know, I was nervous and, you know, the words got mixed up and...
I mean, how...
But, how, you know, that's the big, he was just a human being.
Yeah. How important do you guys think that Bobby Heenan was to that Andre heel package between the beginning of 87 to the split of WrestleMania 6? Because, I mean, in some ways, Andre being as much pain as he was and all that kind of stuff, having Bobby Heenan there to kind of talk the house down all the time, just felt like a great fit.
Oh yeah, I mean, he was the mouthpiece because Andre was never, he never really mastered the English language. And having someone like Bobby Heenan, not only to be his mouthpiece and to cut great promos, but also, you know, as soon as Heenan was getting out of the curtains, he was getting booed the hell out of the building, right? So, especially when you turn someone like Andre, who was a babyface for the longest time, mm-hmm. you need to put him with someone that you know 100% that no one will cheer for him. And that association with Bobby Heenan made that for Andre. Oh, he is with Heenan now, so I don't like him anymore. And that was as simple as that. And, you know, on top of Heenan being that great promo and adding so much to the storyline, it was a huge thing for Andre to be with Heenan during that period of time.
With the manager, it was the key is that the manager could transfer Heat instantly to anyone being associated with him. So in the case of Heenan, he had been at war with Hogan since the AWA days. So with Andre and him together, it became instantaneous. They were the bad
sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned it earlier, Pat, and it's a really great point to bring up, because I think a lot of us, even who watched the shows in 87, 88, 89, don't really think about it when you put it in the perspective of 1988 was really Andre's year. He, you know, WrestleMania 4 did more buys than WrestleMania 3 did. He, SummerSlam 88, debuted a new pay-per-view in the Garden. What do you think it is that, is it just that it's a nicer fairy tale to just say, he, you know, Hogan body slams the Giant and that's the end? Why do you guys think that is the kind of narrative that's put out there, and more isn't talked about that next year where Andre really helped build that foundation that we still see today?
Various reasons. WrestleMania 3 is seen as, even though WrestleMania 4 did more pay-per-view buys, because of the 93,000 people, 78,000 people, the real number, still, it's bigger than what WrestleMania 4 did because it was at the Trump Plaza. So WrestleMania 3 was always seen as a bigger event than WrestleMania 4 because of that. The finish also of the match is different. You know, it's Hogan winning against Andre. It's the passing of the torch, which you don't have at WrestleMania 4 because of the double countout finish, double DQ finish. So I think that because of that, it made for a better story when you have less time to put on Andre's later career. You know, it made like the documentary, the HBO documentary, it fit for a better story to finish his career with 1987 at WrestleMania 3 and then just say that, you know, the later years were not, you know, his best, and go directly to the weeks, you know, preceding his passing. So time constraint also is a reason, or space contained in a book is also another reason why sometimes people will jump directly from 1987 with the passing of the torch directly to the end of his career. We didn't have that. We had, like I said, we have almost 500 pages. We wanted to make sure that we were taking our time, that we would explain every bit of his career, of his personal life, and with that came the realization that, oh, hold on 1 minute, you know, Hogan and Andre was more than just WrestleMania 3. It was the beginning of something else. So it was important for us to discuss that in details.
And one of the other things I wanted to ask you about, because it made me laugh thinking about it, because you always think that Andre the Giant has never seemed more pissed off in his life than when he had to work with the Ultimate Warrior. And you hear all the stories. I mean, it's funny that, you know, I think it was 1989, worst feud of the year in the Wrestling Observer that you guys talked about it was. What was it, you know, about Warrior that Andre didn't like? And the biggest part to me that was fascinating was that Andre would do these 30-second losses on house shows, but on TV there was always protection. Why do you think that was?
I mean, that's just the old school mentality. I mean, that for him, it was probably not a big deal to do those house show losses because, you know, they were not on television and, you know, not as many people knew about them as they would today. Still, probably a lot more knew about them than Andre realized at the time as things were changing. You know, I remember, you know, Pro Wrestling Illustrated Weekly was going on, and there was that fan base that knew a little bit more about those. But I think it was more or less also much easier on him to do those 30 seconds matches that sold the show, basically, you know, the Giant against the Warrior. And it was, you know, he was getting paid the same money. He was not getting paid by the hours either. So I think for him, it was much easier. And, you know, the style with the Warrior, you know, there's so many stories on Warrior being not that easy, it being very green. You know, there's that famous Bobby Eaton story where, you know, Andre had to teach the Warrior to be a little bit looser on stuff. That was all part of the issues. There's some more stories from Vince McMahon, you know, that, you know, until the Warrior figured out that he needed to bring the boss some wine before the matches to get him in a good mood, you know, they were having even more issues. So, you know, it was not easy. And that led to actually Ultimate Warrior challenging Hulk Hogan at the WrestleMania 6. Those wins were important in making Warrior an equal, if you will, to Hogan, because he was the only other one who had taken out the Giant. So that was important too. I mean, if you consider the value of the Ultimate Warrior character, those win over Andre, I mean, meant a lot and made him turn a corner from being the mid card to being a main event. He didn't draw the way they were hoping he was going to be drawing as the world champion, but still, you know, he made the Ultimate Warrior character. And that's a point that can be, put on the table as well, as far as other small things that Andre did after 87 that were not maybe recognized for whatever reason, because of the how they made the old WrestleMania 3 match the center of the mythology, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's interesting. And you know, one of the things that I think is worth bringing up is that I want to thank you guys quickly, because there has been something that has annoyed me as a fan for about 20 years. I always remember seeing Andre being advertised as a participant in the 1991 Royal Rumble. You have confirmed that I was not going mad, that was the case. So thank you for finally putting it in writing so I can tell people I was right. He was supposed to be in it. One of the things about, obviously, his disease. Now, I'm going to butcher the name. Can you say the name of the disease he had? Because I will butcher it.
Acromegaly.
Okay, because as a Scottish guy who has rolling R's, it's not a good idea for me to try and say anything like that. But, you know, the thing that is interesting is that, I don't know if a lot of people know this, he could have had surgery to sort of stop the progression of that and maybe have saved his life and got a lot more time at the end. From what you were able to research, why did he not do that? Why did he not choose to sort of help himself in that way?
And I started the research. It's like, okay, I mean, I know today, you know, Big Show and Lars Sullivan and all have the surgery, and you know that has made a difference. You know, they remain Giant, but you know, it saves their life and a lot of the pain that Andre had to go through. So in my mind, I mean, the only explanation would have been that it was just not available at the time. And then I started to research acromegaly, and I was like, well, that existed for a long, long time. And, you know, surgery was available in the 60s. So I was like, okay, what happened? So, I mean, the more we learn, I mean, it seemed that he was first made aware of acromegaly in Japan. And now, you know, there it's speculation to know exactly how that was presented to him, because it remains that it's not an easy surgery. It's brain surgery. So, you know, anyone being put by a Japanese doctor, a plan to have maybe a brain surgery might not be, you know, the easiest way to understand what's going on and if feel safe in the situation. But, you know, once again, when he got the broken ankle, that was also brought up to him and he just didn't want to do it. And according to Jackie, I mean, it's more or less not wanting to go off the road, not wanting to risk his look as a Giant, believing that he was made that way and that it was perfectly fine. Was it bad advice? Simple scared of surgery? I mean, because, you know, at the time, I mean, it's my understanding that surgery today is a lot less invasive. It would have been slightly more invasive in the 70s. You know, but nothing that would have prevented him from returning to wrestling. So was it just the time off, or the simple scare of a brain surgery? I mean, well, that's one of the other two or three questions that, you know, only Andre could truly answer and give the insight of what was he thinking at the time. But it's part of the tragic story of the giant, because everything that acromegaly gave him, it would also took away towards the end of his life. And he just accepted it, basically.
So, I mean, as we kind of get to the end here, and you guys have, I mean, because how long did you guys spend, Pat, on this? How long was this project for you guys to kind of work on the Andre book?
Not taking into consideration what we already researched or the interviews that we did for our other books, mm-hmm. And not counting the research I did on the documentary, it's a 2-year process, more or less.
Which, you know, is a long time. So I guess what I was wondering was there anything that you came out of it after you'd written the book anything about his legacy that you didn't realize going in before, or something that you kind of came out feeling a little bit differently about? Is there anything that kind of changed for you when you came out at the end of the project?
The only thing that I would have liked to watch before is the Undertaker documentary. Because mm-hmm. the more I was watching it, the more I realized that Taker really became Andre in that locker room. And on so many other facets than just being the leader of the locker room, because we talk about that in the book. But when you watch the documentary, Taker was playing cards. He liked to play cards a lot with other people, you know. He couldn't end his career, you know, that the title of it, The Last Ride, you know. Now he's saying that he's retiring, or that, you know, he doesn't see the day where he's going to wrestle again. But they both had that in common, where Andre didn't want to retire, and Taker didn't want either. So there were so many common grounds between Undertaker and Andre on so many different levels that I would have liked to watch the documentary before. So I think that in a way, Undertaker, you know, kind of took that legacy of Andre in the WWF, in the locker room, and he became that well-respected guy. You know, the guy that when he's playing cards and he's sitting on a, you know, on a chair, everyone comes up to him to shake his hand, mm-hmm. pretty much like the people were doing, the worker were doing for Andre back in the 80s and the 90s. So that's something I would have like to talk a little bit more, and perhaps even try to interview Taker for that, because maybe you know, I would love him to answer that, you know, if he saw himself as the next Andre in that locker room, and you know, how does he see all that, you know. So that's the only thing really important, I'd say. There's always details that we're going to learn here and there, and saying, oh, well, you know, we could have put that in the book, but nothing major, nothing that we really completely forgot or that we didn't talk about.
I mean, I love the fact that we were able to discover a little bit more of the human side of Andre, and that's something that, you know, that was very little known, and I was the most curious about, you know. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, small things like how did it end with his partners in Montreal, and more than likely it's part of a, you know, how his relationship with Frank Valois crumbled, and his issues with Dino Bravo, who was not the easiest person to get along with, and Andre was more of a, because of acromegaly, was more of a, well, I don't have time to lose, so I'm just going to walk away. So that gave me a little more of an insight on the person. And you know, no matter how much you think he dedicated his life to wrestling, I mean, you realize that he gave everything 24 hours a day. You know, as soon as he was out of the hotel or out of the ranch, he was Andre the Giant all the time. There was no Andre Rusimov in there most of the time. Except when he was with his family, in France a couple of times a year, or, you know, so even with the boys, often enough, I mean, so many of them learn about Robin after he was gone. Because, you know, as Boris, his nephew, would say, you know, the Roussimov guys, you know, keep their feelings to themselves a lot.
Men of few words.
So that was important to learn, because that puts everything back in perspective about the legend of Andre the Giant.
You know, Kenny, in a perfect world, we would have been able to interview guys like Dino Bravo and Frank Valois and Vince McMahon Sr., who all had passed away before we even started, you know, working on our first book. So there's a lot of people that in a perfect world would have loved to interview, because they've never spoke about Andre publicly, about the falling out he had with Andre. We had secondhand stories about what did happen. But, you know, in the perfect world, would have loved to talk to Valois and Dino Bravo. What was the issue with Andre? Why did you like him that much? Why did you almost hate him? You know, what was going through your mind at the time? And Vince McMahon Sr., you know, how did he came up with the idea of, you know, sending Andre everywhere else and having a cut on him and everything? There's a lot more that could have been added if we would have been able to talk to those people. But at the same time, we're lucky enough to be able to talk to guys like Paul Vachon, who was his first promoter here for Wrestling Grand Prix in Montreal, and Paul Leduc, who knew him very well when Andre was in Montreal. So that gave the readers a side of Andre that wasn't really talked about before. His whole Montreal debut here and the years he spent here. So you know, at least we're able to talk to some of those guys. But of course, in a perfect world, it would have been really, really awesome to talk to all the ones that have passed away.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Bertrand, you said a man of few words. Luckily, we do not have that problem. We speak of many words. The best compliment I can give you guys, honestly, and I mean it, is when I finished reading the book, I was thinking, God, I wish there was a book like this on Piper or Hogan, like guy, you know, guys that era who you get a real story by talking to a bunch of different people. So I guess with that in mind, are there any more projects on the horizon that you guys can talk about? Is there anything that you're thinking about? Are you looking for a break for a while? How are you feeling?
We're in the break.
Yeah. But
obviously, every project has led to the first. You know, we did the Montreal Mad Dogs Mitchison Screw Jobs. That led us to the Mad Dog Vachon biography. That led me doing the Pat Patterson book with him. And then Pat worked on the Sisterhood of the Square Circle. Then, you know, Pat was involved directly with the documentary. And that opened up the door for this one. So hopefully, you know, we're waiting for that next step. There's a few subjects that we want to tackle, obviously, you know, in regards to characters of the Montreal wrestling territory. So, you know, hopefully it will pan out soon enough.
We're waiting for an answer on a pitch. We just can't talk about it now, but, you know, once it's confirmed, we'll be able to let you and your listeners know about it.
Great. And I assume it's not the Giant Gonzalez biography, but maybe someday one day we'll...
Maybe no. Giant Silva. Maybe Giant Silva.
I would be your one copy that you would sell of that book. Giant Silva, my God, what a blast in the past. Well, listen, guys, give the people who are listening to this, how can they kind of get the book? How can they get the Andre book? How can they keep in touch with you guys and see what is coming up next?
You can reach us through our social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at Pat Leprad, at Bertrand Ebert. You can find all of our books, Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs, The History of Montreal Wrestling Territory, Maurice Vachon, Mad Dog Vachon, The Maurice Vachon Story, Sisterhood of the Squared Circle, The Whole History of Women's Wrestling, Accepted, the Pat Patterson biography, and of course, The Eight Wonder of the World, the true story of Andre the Giant. Everything is available through Amazon, which is, I believe, the easiest way to get it. Sometimes orders might be a little slower because of the pandemic, but it will come through. And you can also go to your local bookstore, and if they don't have it, they should be able to order it for you. So all kind of different ways. There's also the audiobook. There's the Kindle version as well. If you don't want to wait, just, you know, a click or two and you can start reading it. So a bunch of different ways, and, you know, hoping every one of your listeners will get it and you know, appreciate it.
Yeah, I can't recommend it enough. And Bertrand, the countdown to Pat 2021, the sequel begins. I'm sure he'll. Well,
at this point, would do anything to get out of Florida. So going back to England might actually work.
I want to be part of it now. I want to be part of the sequel. I wasn't part of the first time.
Yeah, you need to see this to believe it, Pat. I promise you. Listen, guys, thank you very much. I can't recommend the book enough. It really is great. So thanks for the time and enjoy your vacation. Enjoy some time off.
Thank you
so much, Kenny.
Best. You can be the King Kong banging on your chest.
You can beat the world, you can beat the war. You can talk the guy, go banging on his door.
You can throw your hands up, you can beat the clock, yeah. You can move a mountain, you can break rocks.
You can be a master, don't wait for luck. Dedicate yourself and you go find yourself.
Standing in the Hall of Fame,
yeah.
And the world's gonna know your name.
You can run the mile. You can walk straight through hell with a smile. You could be the hero, you could get the gold. Breaking all the records they thought never could be broke.
Yeah, do it for your people, do it for your pride. And you're never gonna know if you never even try.
Do it for your country, do it for your name. Cause there's gonna be a day.